You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, some farmers are changing grazing practices to try to preserve soil quality for future generations here in Wisconsin and around the country. The creator of the documentary Carbon Cowboys joins the show. First, Governor Evers estimated the coronavirus pandemic to impact Wisconsin financially with around $2 billion in losses. That's an early estimate, but with state revenues threatened, that also hits school funding both short and long term. The uncertainty makes it especially difficult if you're a school system trying to budget for the next school year and beyond. WPR's Milwaukee-based K-12 education reporter Madeline Fox looked into this. She joins us now. Maddie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start with this big report you looked at. This is from the group the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at the problems facing state budgets and district budgets in particular. What were some of the key things they took away from that?
Well, I regret to report that, like just about everything else about this pandemic, we don't really know what it's going to mean. But the best guesses that we have right now is that it's not going to be good. Schools in Wisconsin are funded through a combination, and actually in most states are funded through a combination of state funding and property tax. And as you mentioned, you know, estimates of at least $2 billion in losses to the state, state funding is going to take a real hit from as far as we can tell. And since school funding is about a third of the state budget, there's just very little chance that schools make it through this unscathed. And then on the property tax side, assessment's already in for properties, so technically that shouldn't change. But in practice, I think it's with the kind of economic crisis we're seeing, it's entirely possible that people might not be able to pay their property tax bills, and that could mean another hit to school funding.
And are we talking about, you know, this next school year and then things might go back to normal? Or is there concern that one possible outcome is that this is going to be something that hits schools for years to come?
Right. That is definitely what we saw after the recession in 08 and thereafter, is that, you know, it takes a while for schools to rebound from this, especially schools that don't have a lot of money in reserve. But the fundamental takeaway is it'll depend on what the legislature does. If they decide to go into the budget, go back into this cycle's budget and maybe cut some of the funding that they'd initially promised, it'll be up to them to decide if that's a one-time thing or if they're planning to keep stuff at a cut level until there's an assurance that the economy rebounds. And even if they don't go into this next year's budget, they could do that in later budgets as again. I mean, you don't lose $2 billion in your funding sources and come out totally unscathed. So I think there's no guarantee that things get better just because the coronavirus gets better.
And that's, you bring up an important point with our state budget. It's a two-year budget, and you reported that there was an increase for schools in the budget that we heard a lot about, but a lot of it was backloaded. So it was supposed to kick in for the second year, and now schools who might have been looking forward to that may not get it.
Yes. So the way that school funding in Wisconsin works is that the state legislature caps how much a district can take in per pupil. And they get that, again, through a mix of state funding and property taxes. So if state funding is, let's say their cap, this is totally not what it is, but just for simplicity, let's say their cap was $20 per student. It's many times that. But let's say it was $20 and they were able to get 10 of that from the state. They make up the other 10 with property taxes. It's possible that the state could say, the way things are looking, we're thinking we should cap it at 15 because we can only kick in 7 and we don't want to overburden people on the property tax side. And so it'll depend, again, on if they decide to make that a trend moving forward or not.
We're talking to Madeline Fox, K-12 education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at how the coronavirus, the economic impact is affecting the state budget and how that's having an effect on schools as they try to plan their budgets for next year and beyond. And Madeline, you mentioned the reserve funds. Some schools have a little bit, some have more. What do things look like around the state?
It really, yeah, I mean, that's the simplest way to put it, is that there are some schools that have, because they've been able to raise their revenue limits through referendums in the past, or they've been gaining students, which means they're getting more per pupil funding, they might have more money that was left on the table after they paid for their necessary services. There are other districts maybe that have been losing students, or maybe that have had to deal with a lot of, you know, older buildings that they're coming back from, or just unexpected costs, that have really low reserves. Milwaukee Public Schools is one of those districts with very little in reserve. So it's just like if you went into the coronavirus pandemic without a savings, much of a savings account, and then you got laid off or furloughed. I mean, there's just not, it gives them less room to maneuver, and it means that it's going to be harder for them to get through without making cuts.
And you mentioned unexpected expenses, and that was something with everybody trying to learn from home, school districts trying to figure out, among other things, how to make sure every student had something to learn from or learn on while they were at home. There were some inherent expenses that came along with remote learning, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, some school districts were having books shipped directly to students' houses, and that costs money. Some school districts were having to pay people overtime or hazard pay to come in and clean the building or to go out and drop stuff off on people's porches, like Chromebooks or what have you. And some schools had to order new Chromebooks or like Wi-Fi hotspots and stuff to make sure that kids who weren't connected could be. The takeaway is every district is spending more money to get through this, to adapt, and none of that was planned for, right? So that's going to be another thing that we're not really going to know the full cost of. And then even if students go back in the fall, we might start seeing them go in staggered groups, which might mean that we need to run twice the number of bus routes just to get them in at different times. And that's going to be more expensive. Or it might mean putting new, like just like we're seeing more of the plexiglass shields in grocery stores, there could be some infrastructure changes that are required. So the general consensus is everything is going to cost a little more money. We just don't know exactly how or how much.
And then we have the Federal CARES Act, and that did a lot of things for a lot of different parts of society. That includes some support for schools across the country. What are districts seeing here? How much of a difference maker is it going to be?
Well, that's another one that we don't know for sure. There is, I think, $175 million in federal funding that's supposed to be distributed to Wisconsin public schools. But there are more than 400 school districts. So once you parcel that out, even though, of course, that's probably not going to be parceled out equally, it'll likely depend on school district population, that gets slivered down. And you're talking about school districts that, like I said, are having a lot of really unexpected expenses. And it's just the general consensus that I'm hearing is, again, we really don't know, but there's not a guarantee that it's going to offset all of the extra costs and all of the extra losses.
And as we wrap up, Maddie, we're mostly talking about budgets looking ahead to next fall. You've also reported on what districts are doing for summer school. As we wrap up, what kind of things are we seeing there?
A lot of districts are keeping with the remote learning for summer school. And there's also sort of a doubling down on core programs, so especially math and literacy and reading, because I think that there's a sense that another consequence of this pandemic is that it's likely that there's going to be the same way that you get a summer slide for kids not being in classes, even with remote learning. There's a sense that kids are not learning quite as much. They're not able to take in quite as much. There's also the tremendous stress of a global pandemic that makes it hard to learn, even if you're showing up to your Zoom classes every day. So the summer school focus is, I think, a lot more on just making sure that kids have the core tools that they need. But it is remote for most schools. There's a few districts that are tentatively planning for part of it to be in person. I know Stevens Point area schools have, their plan is, I think, in July to start bringing kids back for summer school, but that's really dependent on what they hear from the state and from the county health department and from a lot of other sources.
Maddie, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Madeline Fox, education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at the challenges facing state schools as they try to budget for next year and beyond. Coming up, a farming practice from the past could be a wave of the future with new experiments in managed grazing in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, people are reporting more mental health problems in the months since the coronavirus outbreak. We'll talk to two psychology experts about what the mental health care field can do to help solve the problem. First, with the pandemic threatening food supply chains in America, that has people's thoughts turning more toward decentralized sources for meat and other products. Sources like some of the farmers in filmmaker Peter Bick's new 10-part documentary, Carbon Cowboys. Bick shows operations in several states and a few outside of the U.S. using a regenerative form of grazing that they say is better for the cows, the soil, and the farmers. Here's a clip of two of those farmers, Gabe Brown speaking first in Bismarck, North Dakota, followed by Alan Williams on his land in Starkville, Mississippi. They've just been talking about using a cocktail of different plants in their grazing fields, as opposed to what used to be considered the easier method of planting a monocrop.
Why do I want to go out and spend thousands upon thousands of dollars every year on synthetic fertilizer when I can grow these crops for just the cost of the seed? They'll make the nitrogen for me, and then my livestock will come around and eat these plants, convert it to dollars for me to sell. So I'm getting all my fertilizer basically for a profit because I'm making money off of these crops.
You know, these plants are just almost going nuts, so to speak, with photosynthetic activity once we take the cattle off. And that is allowing these plants, as they're rapidly regrowing, to capture carbon out of the air, you know, and put it back into the soil.
Peter Bick is professor of practice in the School of Sustainability and Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University. He founded the production company Carbon Nation to make media about climate change solutions. Peter, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
We also wanted to check in on how this type of alternative grazing method is working here in Wisconsin. Joseph Tomendell is executive director of the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship based out of Medford, Wisconsin. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, Joe, let's start here in Wisconsin before we visit the documentary. Can you talk about this concept of regenerative grazing and how it's working these days in Wisconsin?
Sure. So I dairy up in north central Wisconsin, and we're basically a grazing-based dairy farm. And really what we're doing, and this is just a great time of the year for us, is as grass is growing out on our fields, we're rotating the cows every 12 hours through basically a new break of grass and a brand new fresh piece of grass out in the field. So as you know, we're looking around at, you know, a lot of our topography in our rural neighborhoods. You know, we see a lot of brown and a lot of tillage. You know, the fun thing right now is that, you know, from green up, when our lawn started greening up, you know, my fields were already starting to green up and utilizing sunlight and growing grass, and it wasn't much longer, and we had cows out on it. So, you know, from here until the snow flies, we'll have cows out on grass.
And Peter, what led you to want to track people like Joe around the country and actually beyond the country who were doing this kind of thing, rotating their grazing?
First of all, Joe, it sounds beautiful what you're doing. It's nice to meet you. I've came at this through looking for solutions to climate change. And it was clear when I made a film called Carbon Nation that our soils were both a source of carbon if mistreated and a sink for carbon if treated the way nature had intended us to treat soil, which is keep it covered with grass or plants and let all that sunlight do what it's supposed to do, which is feed the world, basically. Let the plants have photosynthesis and draw down CO2 and feed carbon to all the soil microbes and have the system humming along. And so that's why I came at this. And then as I've met farmers, I've become just as much an advocate for farmers as anything else. I'm fascinated by farmers. They're heroes. And I think it's a crime that they're so underpaid and so many of them are in debt. But the folks I've seen who are focusing on nature and focusing on soil health, they're doing well, and that's exciting.
And Peter, something you hear again and again from the farmers you profile is, they see the environmental benefits here, they see the soil benefits, they see the increased biodiversity, but it's also working for them as a business model, this managed grazing.
Well, if you think about it, nature's got about 3.2 billion years of R&D behind it, so it would be good business to use that research and development. And that's really why I'm excited by regenerative agriculture. And we've been focusing on grazing because we think it's a way to turn around soils and get soils rebuilt in a very fast way. But it works because it works for the farmer. It's not about some sort of program that we have to pay farmers to do something because it's good for the world. It's good for the farmer and it's good for the world. And so our goal at Carbon Nation and at ASU is to just make sure that we keep telling these stories because we want farmers to understand that this is an option for them. The last thing I'd ever do is try to make a farmer do something. I'm not going to ever make a farmer do something. But if we can give them information, we can give them options and let them make the decision. I think we'll, I don't know, Joseph, what do you think? Do you think that's a good approach?
Oh, I definitely think it's a good approach, you know, because this is something that it is a bit of a different practice. It's a different management system. You know, once you get it figured out, it really makes sense. It clearly makes sense. But it is difficult. It's a paradigm shift in a way. You know, one of the other passions I have, and as we look at this whole thing, is these farms are different. You know, they're biological systems that are moving. They're changing every day, and people are really the key to these things to manage them. You know, the people and the farmers really need that relationship with livestock, plants, soil, weather. I mean, everything is constantly moving and changing, and that's where, you know, we're really trying to work on who are these next farmers and creating these next farmers. And that's the basis of our work with Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship, is we're identifying farmers who are managing dairy cattle using regenerative managed grazing principles. And we're saying, hey, you know, you're probably the best teacher and the best trainer out there. So what the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship is that it's a formal apprenticeship that, you know, basically is utilizing these farms as a training and as an on-the-job training type of a component to identify those next managers so that we can start, you know, growing the system and managing more land underneath these principles.
That's right, Joe. You're kind of doing two birds here. We've got an aging cohort of farm owners and not necessarily that succession plan in place for who's going to take over. So if somebody goes into the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship, what kind of stuff do they learn from those experienced farmers?
Absolutely. You know, the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship is structured much like just a regular registered apprenticeship in electrical or plumbing or heating or anything like that. And what the apprentice is doing is they're working, they're paid, they're on the farm for 2 years, and we're basically documenting 4,000 hours of on-the-job training and related instruction. You know, 3,700 hours are actually on-the-job training, but they're going through, you know, all sorts of work categories and everything from, you know, milking systems to raising calves, to feed budgeting, to, you know, all aspects of the dairy, including soil health and the financial performance of it, so that they can really get a good understanding of what's going on. These individuals, hopefully, from that is we're giving them the background to become managers, maybe equity earners or full-on successors of these dairies. And that's the other beauty of managed grazing and regenerative dairy is because of the cost structure to get involved in it, it's actually a great way to get that next generation started. And as it's regenerating the soil and all these other things, it's also regenerating our farming population and rural communities.
Talking to Joe Tomendel from the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship based in Medford and Peter Bick, creator of the documentary series on regenerative grazing. It's called Carbon Cowboys. And Peter, another thing that struck me about the really cool people you profile along the way, they are ready to preach about regenerative grazing. I think one of them talked to literally used the word he was preaching about it. They're trying to spread the word.
Well, it's really interesting. It's like they're ready to preach and not ready to preach at the same time. What I've found about farmers is they really don't want to toot their own horn. And yet at the same time, they have a great body of knowledge to share with their neighbors. And a lot of times their neighbors, their conventional neighbors, are curious, but they don't want to pry. And so it's this really interesting thing we've discovered because we're continuing to make a movie. We're making a movie right now about this type of regenerative grazing. And we're also combining it with a big research project to really understand what's the difference between what we're calling adaptive multi-paddock grazing and conventional grazing. You know, is there more carbon being drawn down? Are the birds and wildlife different? And we're seeing that just by us showing up and talking to both sides of the fence, we get conversations going between neighbors. And all of a sudden, they find out that they hadn't really talked about it before, but there's a lot of curiosity. So I think there's a lot of movement potential with the conventional farmers living next door. We were told that everyone thought the adaptive farmer was crazy for trying these new techniques, but I'm starting to see that no, I don't think they think they're crazy. They're just they're curious, but they want to pry. So it's exciting to see.
And I love the excitement. At least one of the farmers, when that new kind of wild grass started showing up in the mix because it wasn't being overgrazed, it was like a new grandkid?
Yeah, that was that's Deborah Clark in our film Herd Impact. Yeah, she says it's like having a new grandchild. Because what she's talking about is what's called the latent seed bank. There's seeds that are 50 years old, 100 years old in pastures that because the pasture's not being grazed in a manner that that seed wants to grow in, it just sits there dormant. And as soon as folks change their methods and start working with nature, all of a sudden all these seeds that a generation or two haven't even seen in that county are showing up. They start growing.
And Joe, are you hopeful that by doing this kind of managed grazing, regenerative grazing, that you know your soil is going to hold up for you know a lot longer than it might have for future farmers?
Definitely. I think it's a clear way to really protect and reinvigorate and regenerate the soil that we have. And right along with it is, you know, we're covering that soil up. So when it comes to, you know, the amount of runoff that we have and soil loss that we have, we're protecting a lot more of it. And we're infiltrating a lot more of it just with the extra organic matter and by retaining that water on that soil longer.
And Peter, as we wrap up, you mentioned some of the research you're involved in right now. What's one more big question you're watching for as maybe more people take this on?
We're measuring the greenhouse gas cycling. What's happening with CO2 and methane and nitrous oxide? And can you draw down enough carbon from the atmosphere to counterbalance the natural methane emissions from the cattle? And the answer is looking like it. So we're seeing farmers like Joseph who are creating greenhouse gas sinks. So the world is better because these people are producing beef and dairy than it was if they weren't producing it. It's very counterintuitive for a lot of folks, but it's exciting, and our data is coming in right now, and I'm excited, and I can't wait to start publishing so that we can really share this with the world.
We'll leave it there for now. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Joe Tomendel, Executive Director of the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship, and Peter Bick, Professor of Practice at Arizona State University, filmmaker behind the new documentary series looking at regenerative grazing. It's called Carbon Cowboys. By the way, we have a link up at WPR.org/Central Time if you want to check out some clips from that documentary. Coming up, our guests say it's time to flatten another health curve of anxiety and depression. We'll check out the scope of the problem and what we can do about it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, grandparents can play a really big role in the lives of their grandkids. Meet the author of the book, Grand, A Grandparent's Wisdom for the Next Generation. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has taken over 100,000 American lives and led to a big spike in unemployment. The outbreak is also taking a big toll on the country's mental health. Recent surveys show a big jump in people reporting symptoms of anxiety, depression, and other mental distress in recent months. That means there is a rising demand for mental health care, and as our two guests wrote about in the recent piece for The Conversation, the field may have to rethink the way it works in order to help more people. June Gruber is an assistant professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder and director of the Positive Emotion and Psychopathology Lab there. June, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Jonathan Rottenberg is a professor and director of clinical training in the psychology department at the University of South Florida. He's author of The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. John, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, June, the piece that the two of you co-wrote starts by saying that this mental health crisis triggered by COVID-19 is escalating rapidly. Can you give us a sense of the scope of the problem we're looking at here?
I think what we're looking at is a new wave or surge of mental health difficulties and challenges that are really unlike anything we've seen before. We're seeing that, you know, from 2018 to 2020, adults in the U.S. are now 8 times more likely to meet criteria for serious mental distress, and nearly 1/3 of Americans are reporting really clinically significant and concerning symptoms of anxiety or even clinical depression. So this is a new landscape we're facing with mental health and mental health challenges. And it's not like anything in our training and experience as clinical psychologists and psychology researchers that we've faced before.
And John, this comes as people have a harder time going to in-person kind of treatment. So this is kind of a double whammy. We've got this big jump in demand here, but it's harder to get, even harder than it already was, to get access to treatment. Can you talk about that?
Sure, that's a really important point. The pandemic, in addition to being terrifying and disruptive and harmful to the economy and in really putting people's lives into chaos, it's also interfering with how people ordinarily cope. For example, the physical distancing recommendations for some people are breeding a kind of social isolation and are interfering with how they typically cope, right? We call a friend or we go, we don't want to hug a friend. And the pandemic has made that a lot more difficult. And so in addition to the, as you mentioned, the difficulty of face-to-face therapy, there's the difficulty that it's interfering with a lot of the typical ways that people cope with stress.
And a big part of your piece, June, that we're talking about is putting out the idea that, hey, in this case, the mental health community, is going to have to find creative ways to give people what they need in ways that we really haven't done as much before. What kind of solutions do you see out there?
Sure. I mean, the way we've thought about this is a change to mental health care perhaps was overdue before the pandemic, but what the pandemic has really highlighted to us and really served as a catalyst for in many ways are really radical ways we need to reimagine mental health care. So a few ideas that we have thought could be timely and should be implemented as soon as we're able to are, one, really thinking about changing the way we think about therapy as an in-person, one-to-one experience between a client and a therapist, and that we really need to think about remote-based opportunities through telehealth. We also need to think about, really reimagining who is the mental health provider. So typically it is an expert therapist or expert psychiatrist, but that in fact, there's a lot of success in peer-based interventions where people are really connecting with and relying on their community for a source of support as well. So we need to kind of think beyond in-person models and beyond simply the expert therapist and the client model. I think that's one big piece we think needs to change. I think the other thing that we think a lot about is that we need to refocus on simply treating symptoms of depression, for example, or anxiety once they're already there and taking a more proactive approach. So trying to focus on fostering wellness really early on and thinking about general interventions that we know promote well-being for everyone, whether we're in the early stages of depression or more further along. That could be exercise, sleep hygiene, spending time outdoors. We really need to sort of also expand the scope of what we think about can be useful to alleviate mental distress and suffering.
John, I'm really interested in that peer-based thing June was just talking about. I've interviewed one or two people here in Wisconsin who have done things like that in rural areas where there may not be a lot of access to mental health care, where farmers, some of them face severe mental health problems, concerns about suicide. And at least anecdotally, it sounds like a great program. What would it take to do this kind of thing at scale to have meaningful, useful peer mental health groups like that around the country?
I mean, it already exists. I'm sure you've heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is a kind of peer-delivered intervention. And I think that we can build upon the success of existing programs by giving people some training, some orientation. People who've gone through these kinds of experiences, for example, people who've struggled with depression, can help their peers cope and get through these kinds of experiences. So it's not something that would require a tremendous, this is not a moonshot. This would not require a tremendous amount of development. It's things that we already know have some degree of efficacy.
We're talking to Jonathan Rottenberg from the University of South Florida and June Gruber from the University of Colorado Boulder, both psychology professors, and we're talking about their concerns about a wave of mental health problems facing Americans in the midst of and in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, and trying to figure out how to meet the needs of people dealing with these problems. June, is part of the problem here that now maybe, as always, people are less likely to come forward and talk about a mental health problem versus, hey, if you've lived through COVID-19, you might talk about it. If you live through depression during COVID-19, you might not.
I mean, that's a really great question. We know that there still is an existing stigma that can loom over mental illness in a way that we don't see as commonly with different physical ailments. But I think now more than ever, people are speaking up and speaking out and communicating with each other across all parts of the world. So I think we actually have a real opportunity for people to share their common experiences, and that many people are suffering through this pandemic. And what we think of as, you know, quote, abnormal psychology, things that we think are rare, are now more shared than ever, whether they're symptoms of severe depression, insomnia, paralyzing anxiety, and that it might be a real opportunity to come together and connect and destigmatize mental illness in a much overdue movement that's needed too.
And John, how about even knowing that there's a problem there? If we have really bad symptoms that sound like COVID-19 now, for the most part, we could get a blood test. It can be harder to self-diagnose that anxiety or depression or other mental health problem.
Yes and no. As June's saying, that I think there is increased awareness now as opposed to the past. And part of the point of our article is that there is an opportunity as people become more aware. They also are beginning to become aware of some of the tools that exist for self-diagnosing. So, of course, a qualified mental health professional is great. If you can afford it, if you can access it, strongly recommend that. But there are screening tools online that are vetted. And there are also tools online that model a lot of the features of therapy that are self-paced. And so intelligent rollout of these kinds of tools are, I think, potentially really transform how mental health problems are diagnosed and how they're treated as well.
Jude, are you seeing these kind of things rolled out with any sense of urgency, whether we're talking about expanding the kind of peer counseling you were talking about or what John was talking about with these online platforms?
I think there's a shared interest in people and the community taking mental health care into their own hands and in the kind of clinical psychology community of a revolution and how we think about and implement mental health care. I think the action still needs to happen. That's why we wrote this article. We're highlighting sentiments and perspectives that the community and mental health professionals share, but we need to now motivate that change to happen.
We're talking to June Gruber from the psychology department at the University of Colorado Boulder and Jonathan Rottenberg, also in psychology at the University of South Florida. They co-wrote a piece on the conversation titled "Flattening the Mental Health Curve is the Next Big Coronavirus Challenge." You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with more feelings of anxiety or depression during the pandemic? Is that a new problem or maybe re-emerging? Have you been cut off from the usual things you seek for support, whether that is some kind of professional therapy or, you know, just your peer group, your friends? Have you tried remote care? How has that worked? And flipping things around, if you work in on the treatment side of things, what are you seeing? What have you been able to do to reach out to people, maybe in different ways than you were able to in the past? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with June Gruber, assistant psychology professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and Jonathan Rottenberg, professor of psychology at the University of South Florida. We're talking about ways to flatten the mental health curve we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot more people reporting problems with things like depression and anxiety. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have the past few months been difficult for your mental health or for someone maybe in your family or circle of friends? If you were able to get in-person treatment of some sort in the past, how have things changed? How are they working now? What do you want to see from the mental health care field? And if you are in the mental health care field, what do you think needs to happen to help address this problem? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. And John, we've alluded to this some. Even pre-pandemic, there wasn't necessarily the access to affordable mental health professional treatment. Is that a problem you'd like to see addressed, even though that's probably something that's not going to be able to spin up in the short run?
And One of the big reforms that needs to be made is changing how insurance reimbursement works. Right now, for most people, if you have insurance, physical health conditions are reimbursed much more generously than our mental health care conditions. And that's something that really retards people's ability to get into therapy and to stay into therapy. But again, I think it is a surmountable challenge. It's something that can be done.
And June, can you talk about this? People might think mental health, well, that doesn't sound as urgent as, you know, a deadly disease, but there are some life or death consequences here. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, certainly. So mental health challenges can bring immense suffering and impairment to day-to-day activities, but in some serious cases, they can also lead to death due to taking one's own life. And indeed, we're seeing some recent, very alarming projections suggesting that deaths connected to or stemming from mental health issues may rival deaths directly due to the virus itself. So one study from the Wellbeing Trust suggested that COVID may lead from anywhere from, you know, close to 28,000 to over 150,000 additional deaths of despair. So this is not something to be taken lightly. It's as serious as the physical infection risk that we've been spending a lot of time addressing as a nation and world.
And John, we've had conversations on this show in the past about this concept of these deaths of despair, already a problem in the years before we heard of COVID-19. Can you talk about that problem, you know, even before 2020?
Yeah, sadly, you know, there are a lot of people in the United States that feel socially isolated, that feel that their lives aren't meaningful. And those are people who are more ripe for having problems with substances. And unfortunately, substance abuse and in overdose is one of the big categories of the deaths of despair, in addition to suicide, as June alluded to.
June, do we know about the kind of interventions for these deaths of despair that are effective, even in normal times?
Absolutely. So the good news is that we do have a lot of available data on empirically supported treatments that help with suicidal ideation, self-harm, and depressed mood that all can relate to an increased risk for suicide. So these include interventions such as cognitive behavioral therapy, as well as dialectical behavioral therapies examples. And now the real challenge is how to make sure that we're disseminating those interventions now to people who need them the most, but may be isolated at home.
We are talking about mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot more people in the United States reporting concerns about depression, anxiety, and other mental health problems. June Gruber is with us, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. Also, Jonathan Rottenberg, Professor and Director of Clinical Training in the Psychology Department at the University of South Florida, talking about a piece they wrote on The Conversation on this topic and ways that they say we can help address this problem, and maybe by making some quick changes, save lives along the way. John, for people listening now saying, yeah, this is me. I have depression. I have anxiety. They may not have access to that treatment. Are there things they can reach out to online, say, right now that might be able to help them?
Yeah, I mean, even in our article, we highlight a couple of resources such as the online cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy. And we also, I mean, this may sound hokey, but there are mental health programs that are available for free on the web. For example, there are podcasts. We link to some of those in web-based tools that people can use. But in addition to all those, I think that sometimes people don't use everything that's in their support network. So there's a lot of people who are struggling with depression who feel isolated and feel like they can't talk about it and don't talk about it. And so one additional step, so we're sort of an all of the above proponent, is using those support networks, start that conversation. I know it's hard. There's a lot of trepidation about talking about things like depression in yourself or with a family member. But in these times, we all need to band together. And if that's over the phone or over a Skype as opposed to in person, we all have to make the best of the situation.
June, I want to expand on something you touched on earlier as part of your plan that you proposed in the piece we're talking about, the idea of making us overall a more a society more devoted to mental health, expanding our mental health well-being in our daily lives, what would that look like?
I think this would look like a world in which we treat mental health as important, but as common and everyday as we treat, let's say, our different aspects of our physical health. So one analogy that we've often talked with a colleague of ours is the way we sort of think about something as simple as dental health care, right? It's something that we all go in for preventative treatment, that we all talk about in a non-stigmatized way, and that we try to provide access to. And I think we need to think of mental health as something as ordinary and common as, you know, taking care of our teeth, that we need to, you know, even if we're not actively suffering, we need to be taking steps to promoting health and wellness, and that we know where resources are, and that seeking them out is incredibly common and normalized when we are suffering, or more severely, or even moderately.
Getting back to the cause side of the problems here, John, not only have we had this disease, but we've had the economic hit we've taken over the last couple of months. Is that making things even more difficult for people?
I'm afraid so. The coronavirus contains pretty much every aspect of what we call in a different piece, a toxic stressor, because it involves this great uncertainty about the future. It involves economic stress. It involves, quite obviously, a threat to physical well-being, and you worry about the health of yourself, you worry about the health of your loved ones, and there's this tremendous uncertainty about the future. And so while on the one hand, we're all in this together, but on the other, there's a kind of social isolation that has been going on, that's been a consequence of a pandemic. We're not able to, share a meal with our friends, or go out to our favorite restaurant, and it again interferes with a lot of the ways that we typically cope with stress.
When you lay it out like that, there's a lot going on. June, is there something to be said for just acknowledging that, hey, we're up against a lot right now, and it's normal maybe that it's making us feel bad right about now?
I think so. I think one of the biggest pieces we need to acknowledge and accept is that emotions of anger, sadness, and fear are incredibly normal and common, and one could even argue appropriate. We are facing stressors, sort of a perfect storm of stressors that John mentioned, that's unlike anything we've seen before. And to feel, you know, exuberant or happy in the midst of it, of that would be inappropriate and concerning, that it makes sense we're feeling stressed and anxious, and that is really us responding to a really uncertain world right now.
And John, as we wrap up, are you optimistic that we're going to be able to roll out some things that are going to help people, you know, as soon as we need them?
I really am. And so we wrote an article, Big Deal, but we also managed to work with a team of 30 psychologists. I've never seen like anything like this in my whole career. And we got them on the same page, and we wrote a much longer piece. And everyone kind of dropped what they were doing to talk about what we needed to do as a field. So I think there's a really strong commitment in the field of clinical psychology to try to roll out some of these tools. And I know for God's sake, there's a strong need for these. So I think the two things are gonna merge nicely. There's a strong need, and there's a strong urge to connect people with tools that will make it better. As you said, it's not going to be a cure-all, but to make it better, I think that would be a really welcome step.
We'll leave it there. John, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
And June, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That's June Gruber from the University of Colorado Boulder and Jonathan Rottenberg from the University of South Florida. They talked with us about a spike in mental health problems people were reporting during the COVID-19 pandemic. We've got a link to one of the resources they talked about at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you or a loved one are concerned about suicidal thoughts, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number is 1-800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll look at plans for exploratory mining along the Wolf River in northern Wisconsin, what it could mean for the future, and concern about the possible impacts. And a lot of people keep scrapbooks. We'll get advice and stories and learn some of the history, too. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, journalists are covering protests, COVID-19, and elections around the country at a time when local newspapers and other outlets have been dealing with staffing cuts. Kate and her guests look at the challenges facing journalism in 2020. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll meet a researcher who's been tracking as every detail of his own life for about a decade now. He'll tell us what we can learn by keeping track of what we're doing and then going back and reading it later. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.